and then I never remember it. Okay. So this conversation, this all of the discourse conversation has to do with this period of time that just precedes the second advent, his return to earth, that we know of as the tribulation period. And don't cheat and look at the chart, but tell me how long a period of time that is. 7 years, isn't it? Yeah, why is that? Why is it 7 years? It's Daniel's 70th week, and the week there means a unit of 7 years. So this is the last of Daniel's prophecy concerning the 490-year prophecy we got back here in Daniel. So we know it's 7 years long right here. So he's describing to the disciples, in answering their question, what are the signs associated with your coming back? He's doing that for them. And what he's told them so far is that this time period right here will be characterized by wars, rumors of wars, earthquakes, famines, pestilence, all those things we've seen before, but I think the magnitude and the frequency of them here will be higher than what we've experienced, and that's why it will actually stand out as a sign. This will be a bad time right here. Most of that will occur in the first half of this 7-year interval. And then he said right here at the middle of it, there is a real milestone for the Jews living in that day to watch for. And that milestone was the setting up of himself in the temple to be worshipped by the Antichrist. The Lord calls him the abomination that desolates in this conversation he's having here. But he goes by 30 different names, so you can pick any one you want to. We usually call him the Antichrist, but the abomination of desolation is what he is also. He's that guy who will set himself up to be worshipped in the middle of this 7-year period of time and will turn on Israel with a vengeance. So he tells them, he said, when that happens, when you see that happen, get out of there. Don't go back and get your goods or anything like that. Just flee that nation as fast as you can. Get out of Jerusalem, head to the mountains, try to take some cover somewhere, because he's going to turn on you, and the death rate in Israel will be 2 out of 3 will die. Zechariah chapter 12 tells us only 1 in 3 will survive in the land in the tribulation period. So he says, get out of there and run for the hills. So that's what he's told them so far. Now, this conversation is broken into two chapters in our English Bible, chapter 24 and 25. But remember, those chapter breaks are not divinely inspired. Men have decided that makes good sense, so let's draw a chapter break here and we'll put this in this next chapter and so on. This whole thing is one conversation. And in this one conversation called the Olivet Discourse, there's three themes that the Lord develops in that conversation. The first one is the future. That's what we've been talking about. He tells them what's going to happen here. That's theme number one. Theme number two is his return and its effect on Jews. What's going to happen to the Jews when he comes back right here? That's theme number two. Theme number three is his return and what's going to happen to the Gentiles at that time. What will happen to them when he returns? So the conversation is future events, my return and its effect on Jews, and three, my return and its effect on Gentiles. That's the conversation, regardless of the chapter break. Okay? So last week in chapter 24, as he got through telling essentially about the signs associated with his coming, he gave them then some lessons for the Jews to be aware of and to think about, and the impact of his coming on them. He used it to illustrate, he used a fig tree to illustrate the certainty of it and the proximity of it when you see certain of these events start to take place in through here. He said, look, like a fig tree, when you see that thing blooming out, you know that summer's right around the corner. So when you see these events start to take place, I'm right around the corner. He's going to be back very soon. Then he said the time period would be a lot like the days of Noah, that is, indifference, nobody paying any attention to it. A complete indifference to spiritual truths and judgments that are pending. So like the days of Noah when no one paid any attention to it until it started raining real hard. And it will be like that there. And then he used a theme of separation in verses 40 and 41 of chapter 24. there will be a separation here before this thing right here starts. When he comes back, he's going to separate the righteous from the unrighteous, both amongst the Jews and amongst the Gentiles. Those are the developing themes that he's presented so far. Now, he's going to go on here in the rest of chapter 24 and the first part of chapter 25 to emphasize to the Jews, and there's a secondary application that we can make to ourselves from these principles, but it's primarily, I think, for the Jews that will be living at that time. It's a lesson for them that we can also kind of maybe glean something from. But he's going to tell them in verse 42 and following, he says, therefore, be on the alert, because you don't know which day that your Lord is coming. So Jews living during this time frame here, and you start to see these events take place, be alert to the fact that the Lord is about to come back. Be sure of this, that if the head of the house had known at what time of the night the thief was coming, he would have been on the alert and he would not have allowed his house to be broken into. If you know someone's going to break into your house and you know when, you can be ready for them, can't you? Well, they're not going to know exactly when, but he's telling them to be ready nevertheless. Be alert, be aware. And for this reason, you be ready also, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour when you do not think he will. So all you Jews living during the tribulation period, when you see this stuff start to happen, be aware that the Lord is just about back. And then he's going to give some further illustrations here on what their attitude should be. Faithful versus unfaithful, wise versus unwise, that sort of thing. All right. So then in verse 45 of chapter 24, he goes on and say, who then is the faithful and sensible slave whom his master put in charge of his household to give them their food at the proper time? This is an appeal to faithfulness. He's using the analogy of a steward of a household. In that day, the steward of the household was in charge of the family's resources. All of their stores go into this storage place, and the steward then takes out the stuff to feed the family with as is needed. He manages all the family resources. Today it might be your CPA, okay? He's got all your money, and he manages it for you, something like that. Well, the faithful one of those guys who manages a household gave them their food at the proper time. He took care of things. Blessed is that slave whom his master finds so doing when he comes. Faithfulness is what is being blessed here on the part of these Jews of that day. Truly I say to you that he will put him in charge of all of his possessions. So if you're faithful in some things, the Lord will put you in charge of many things. Faithfulness during this period right here is the key to success for the Jewish believer during that time. But if he says, if that slave says in his heart, well, my master is not coming for a long time, that is, I don't believe these signs that I'm seeing here. He ain't coming back. These don't mean nothing. We've had earthquakes before. We've had wars before. This doesn't mean anything. He ain't coming back. If he takes that attitude and shall begin to beat his fellow slaves and eat and drink with drunkards, the master of that slave will come on a day when he does not expect him and at an hour which he does not know, and shall cut him in pieces and assign him a place with the hypocrites. Weeping shall be there and gnashing of teeth. That unfaithful Jew living during this time period here will be cast out when the Lord comes back here. And the place that he's going to be cast into is described here as weeping and gnashing of teeth. That doesn't sound like a real nice place to be, does it? No. The eternal damnation of the lost, is there's nothing pleasant about it. We'll see some more about it here in just a little bit. But the lack of faithfulness on their part will cast them into outer darkness. There is a separation that takes place here at his return for the Jews that we're talking about now. He was going to talk about the Gentiles in just a bit. We're still talking about the Jews now. Another lesson, another teaching of a similar principle involving 10 virgins. Now, the analogy that he's using here is the Jewish wedding of that day, not like what we do today. But in that day, the way this took place is that the groom would go from his place over to the bride's place and pick her up, usually taking a few buds along with him. And there would be sort of a wedding party waiting for him to come back with her. And they would have some festivities and celebrations at her place of undetermined length of time. And then he comes back with her to his place where the real activities start. So that's kind of the way the wedding pattern went. So you got some people waiting back at the groom's house for him to go get his bride and come back. And their job is to go out and greet him when the wedding party comes back to his place. Got the picture in mind? All right, here's what the Lord teaches about the kingdom using that event. Then the kingdom of heaven will be comparable to 10 virgins who took their lamps and went out to meet the bridegroom. All right, this is the group waiting back at the groom's house, waiting for him to come back, sort of a welcoming party or whatever. 5 of them were foolish and 5 were prudent. So these 10 welcomers, 5 of them show some good sense and 5 of them do not. All right, got the picture now still? For when the foolish took their lamps, they took no oil with them. So they just carry a lamp to light when he comes back and to use in the greeting and so on. But they didn't take any additional oil with them. But the prudent, they did. They took oil and flasks along with their lamp. So they got a lit lamp and they got some backup oil to fill it again. Got the picture? These 5 are standing there with just lamps. These 5 have got lamps and oil. They were prudent. They were not. Now, while the bridegroom was delaying, he spent longer over at her place than they thought. They all got drowsy and began to sleep. But at midnight, there was a shout, "Behold, the bridegroom come! Behold, the bridegroom come out to meet him." So he finally gets over there, and the word gets quickly passed to all the welcomers, all the greeters. "Hey, here he comes. Get ready." So then all those virgins arose and trimmed their lamps. The foolish said to the prudent, "Well, give us some of your oil, for our lamps are going out." Oh, wow. He took so long, our lamps burn out, and we didn't bring any extra oil. So give us some of your oil. But the prudent said, "Don't think so. No, there won't be enough for us and you too. Go instead to the dealers and buy some for yourselves. Go take care of business yourselves." And while they were going away to make the purchase, the bridegroom came and those who were ready went in with him to the wedding feast, and the door was shut. Got the picture? 5 of them are off trying to procure some oil, and the wedding feast began and the door was shut, and they're on the outside looking in. And later the other virgins who came saying, "Lord, Lord, open up for us." Here they come. They finally come back. But they answered and said, "Truly I say to you, I do not know you. So be on the alert then, for you do not know the day nor the hour." So the picture is one of having certain Jews who respond to these signs in faith and are prepared for his return, and certain Jews who are not prepared for his return. They're the ones that are shut out. They're not going to be in the kingdom. The faithless ones will not go into the kingdom. The faithful, the prudent ones, will. Janelle.
I heard somebody talking about this, and they were saying that when the bridegroom was delayed, that he had been preparing a room. Remember, it says, Jesus said, "I go to prepare a room for you," in John 15, but he said when the bridegroom is delayed, he has to wait for the father to tell him it's time to go, to pick up the bride.
Oh, to leave his house to go get the bride? Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be a good analogy. That's right, because the father is usually the one that prepared the room for the new couple. So he could be waiting for that. Yeah, that would fit the analogy okay also.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he's only been building that thing for 2,000 years. But since it's going to house about 10 billion people, it's a big job, isn't it? At any rate, yeah, that would fit the analogy pretty well also. So that's the next lesson for those Jews, is to be faithful and prudent and ready for his return when he does come. Another lesson involves the use of resources. The concept of faithfulness is at the root of all of these lessons he's given here. But this next one is similar. He says, look, it's just like a man who is about to go on a journey who called his own slaves and entrusted his possessions to them. To one he gave 5 talents, to another 2 talents, and to another 1, each according to his own ability, and he went on his journey. So he divides up his resources and he gives them to his slaves. The value of a talent can vary over time, and so, you know, we could talk about it, but it doesn't matter all that much. The point is that one guy got a bunch, another guy got some, and another guy got just a little bit, according to their abilities. And so the guy distributed out his resources according to how he thinks the guys can manage it. Okay? One is a big sum, one's a medium sum, one's a small sum. And so he leaves. And immediately the one who had received the 5 talents, he went and traded with them, and he gained 5 more talents. Oh, this is the investment company you want to put your money with. This guy did well. In the same manner, the one who received 2 talents, he gained 2 more. That'd be an okay company too. They did well, didn't they? They doubled what was left in their possessions, both of them. But the guy who received only 1 talent, he went away and dug in the ground and hid his master's money. Well, I guess he thought it would grow in the ground, huh? Got a different concept toward money. Must have been green bills of some kind, I guess. He just plants it in the ground, doesn't do anything with it. Now, after a long time, the master of the slaves came and settled accounts with him. And the one who had received 5 talents came up and brought 5 more talents, saying, Master, you entrusted me with 5 talents. See here, I have gained 5 more talents. So the first guy comes up and shows what he did with his resources. And his master's response in verse 21 is, well done, good and faithful slave. You were faithful with a few things. I'll put you in charge of many things. Enter into the joy of your master. What is the basis of this guy's reward? The amount that he made? What is he commended for? His faithfulness, right? Faithfulness. Our relationship with God is never a numbers game. It is a faith game. It is the condition of the heart that matters, not numbers. So this guy is rewarded not on the basis of the fact that he made 5 more talents, but that he was faithful. And the one who had received 2 talents came up and said, Master, you entrusted me with 2 talents here. I've gained 2 more. And he said to him, well done, good and faithful slave. You were faithful with a few things. I'll put you in charge of many things. Enter into the joy of your master. Verbatim what he told the other guy. Faithfulness was the basis of the reward. He wasn't rewarded less because he only worked with 2 talents. He was rewarded because he was faithful, just like the other guy. So both of these guys are rewarded the same for faithfulness. And here comes the other guy. The one who also received the 1 talent came up to his master and said, Master, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you did not sow and gathering where you scattered no seed. And I was afraid and went away and hid your talent in the ground. See here, you have what is yours. Well, that's not quite that's a hard sell story that he's trying to use there, isn't it? His master answered him and said, you wicked, lazy slave. A little bit of a contrast between him and the first 2 guys, huh? They're good and faithful. He's wicked and lazy. You said that you thought I was hard and that I reap where I did not sow and gathered where I scattered no seed. Then you ought to put my money in the bank, and on my arrival I would have received my money back with interest. Why do you think the guy did not put the talent in the bank? Instead, he buried it in his backyard, out there beside him dog bones. Well, there'd be a record of it if he put it in the bank, wouldn't he? But there's no record of it if he just buries it in the backyard. So if his master did not come, he could just keep the money. But if he put it in the bank's got the money. He doesn't think the guy's coming back. He's totally faithless. He said, I'm going to put this somewhere where I can get to it if he doesn't come back. It's a thought process that I think Judas went through too. We'll talk about that later when we get to him. And that is, at least there's something in it for me. I'll just keep these talents and use them for myself. He is the faithless one of the three. What's his reward? Therefore, take away the talent from him and give it to the one who has the 10 talents. He doesn't get to keep the one he thought he was procuring by burying it, not believing his master would ever come back, because they took it away from him. Everyone who has shall more be given, and he shall have abundance. But from the one who does not have, even what he has will be taken away from him. And cast the worthless slave into outer darkness, in the place there shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. He is separated from the faithful by being cast into outer darkness, where there's weeping and gnashing of teeth. What is outer darkness? I wonder what that is. The term outer darkness kind of implies that it's somewhere removed from, it's set apart from the other place of the eternal dwellings. Maybe the new heaven and the new earth, which will be lit by the glory of God. Maybe if you get far enough away from that, there is a darkness that those people can't see, believers can't see. And it's called outer darkness. Not just darkness, but it's outer. It looks like it's away from the faithful. So the separation looks like it's very, very far apart. And what is darkness? It's an outer darkness. How is it that darkness is a characteristic of the abode of the lost forever, I wonder? Do we know anything about darkness?
Jesus is the light, and so if he's not there, it's darkness.
Darkness is just the absence of light. Mm-hmm. So we know that if they are so far removed from the presence of God, who is lighting the new heavens and the new earth, they're in the absence of light, they're in darkness. In Exodus chapter 10, that last plague, you remember down there in Egypt, was darkness. But there it is said it was a darkness that they could feel. What's that? How do you feel darkness?
Carlsbad Cavern.
I have been there, and I'm glad there's lights down there is all I got to say. And it said there, by the way, also in Exodus 10, that 10th plague, that they couldn't see one another. You ever been in darkness where you can't see people in your face? That's about that bad there. I put my hand on my nose down in there, and I don't think I could see it. Now, I know that's still a long way away from my face, but still, it ain't that far. It is dark down there. So one of the characteristics that we know about the abode of the lost, in addition to that weeping and gnashing of teeth, that sounds like misery, is that it is a dark place, at least in some regards, and apparently maybe they can't even see one another there. I don't know. I don't know all that there is to know about that place, but everything I do know about it, I don't want to be there. It's a horrible place. And that's what awaits the faithless. So his coming back here, in regards to Jews that are living here, is that the faithful will go into the millennium, the faithless get cast into this final abode of the lost. And it is a horrible, horrible sounding place.
Jesus is the light. It's separation from Jesus. Darkness is separation.
Yeah.
Jesus.
It seems to have some kind of a divine quality to it, though, that's a little different than just your average absence of light, because if you can feel it, and you can't see anything in it. It seems to be maybe even be a divine recipe that we maybe don't know a whole lot about. I don't know. That's theme number two. That's the theme of his return and its effect on the Jews. And clearly, their faithfulness is the basis for the separation.
John,
all right.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, ma'am.
In the 24, when he said, "I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you have not sown and gathering where you have not scattered seed," can't you just say that he had such an erroneous idea of who the master was?
Yeah. Yeah. Quite an attitude toward him, isn't it?
Yeah.
There's really no limit to the ignorance of unbelief or to the bad attitude or bad impressions that people can have of unbelief. And that guy's kind of representing them there with that kind of an attitude. Here are these other guys that are delighted to have the resource. They go out and do their thing, and they are perfectly fine. They're faithful, and they're welcomed in. And this guy just thinks his master's a mean, hard, cruel person. So, yes, I think the contrast between them and him, those two and him, the third guy, you can see in his description of his master there. Okay. Would you like a padded chair? Would that help any? Okay. All right. Theme number three, the Lord's return and its effect on Gentiles. We've seen the future. We've seen his return and its effect on Jews. And now we're going to see his return and its effect on Gentiles, theme number three in this discourse. But when the Son of Man comes in his glory and all his angels with him, how many is that, you think? Well, it's two-thirds of the original number, it appears. Satan looked like captured one-third of them to follow him, so it's the other two-thirds. And if they're guardians of those that are going to inherit salvation, and we know that any point in time you could maybe be talking about at least a billion or something like that, people on earth that are believers over some point in time. Their numbers, I would think, would number in the billions. Does that seem reasonable? I don't know. I'm just guessing based on what little we got here. So when he comes back, here comes these immeasurable hordes of angelic beings with him. And then he'll sit on his glorious throne, and all the nations will be gathered before him. Who's that? Who are the nations? Gentiles, yeah. This is the third theme. This is a different group than the previous ones we saw. These are the Gentiles now are going to be gathered before him. I gather that they will be somehow or another regathered through the angelic ministries, just like the Jews were, and brought to some place of judgment, probably in Jerusalem. I don't know, but probably. And he will separate them from one another as the shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. In this separation now, the analogy is between sheep and goats. One group is going to be represented by the sheep and the other group represented by the goats. Probably just arbitrary. He'll put the sheep on his right hand. That's usually the place of blessing and righteousness. And his goats on the left. That's usually not good. It's always better to be on the right than on the left. And the king will say to those on his right, these were the righteous ones, "Come, you who are blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world." So these guys, these believing Gentiles, will go into the kingdom also. They're the sheep. But the goats, the other guys, he'll say on the left, the king will say to those on the right, "Come in here to the kingdom, prepare for the foundation of the world." And he gives them the basis for that. He says, "I was hungry and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. I was a stranger and you invited me in. Naked and you clothed me. And I was sick and you visited me. I was in prison and you came to me." And they'll say back to him, the righteous, that is, will say, "Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you and thirsty? Or when did we give you drink? When did we do? We didn't see you during this time period right here. So when is it that you say we actually did these good things for you?" How was that? We didn't see you. And he says, he said, verse 10, verse 40, the king will answer and say to them, truly I say to you, to the extent that you did it to one of these brothers of mine, even to the least of them, you did it to me. Yes. So his answer is that, yeah, you're right, I wasn't here, you didn't see me, I wasn't leaving any footprints on the place here, but my followers were. These faithful believing Jews that lived during the tribulation period will be treated by the world in some way. Some will treat them like Corrie ten Boom, and others will treat them like Hitler. Some will help them and provide for them and nurture them and visit them and clothe and so on. And others will try to kill them. And the Lord says, to the extent that you helped one of my followers during that time frame, one of these faithful Jews, you did it to me. There is such a union between him and his followers that they are equated here. And the treatment of them is equated. So the good guys, the righteous, the sheep that are going into the millennium, illustrate their faith by the way they treat the Jews during that tribulation period. It isn't the work that they did. It's their faith that is illustrated by the work that they did that will be the basis for their righteousness. And then the corollary is true as well. Then he will also say to those on his left, depart from me, accursed ones, into the eternal fire which has been prepared for the devil and his angels. By the way, there aren't any pit stops on the way to glory. There is no purgatory. That concept is not biblically based. To be absent from the body is to be at home with the Lord. There aren't any stops into a purgatory type of situation that you can then earn your way out of. That concept has no basis in Scripture at all. So, don't get ever hung up on that thing. He tells them to depart. By the way, that he told the thief on the cross, today you will be with me in paradise. He didn't stop off anywhere along the way, did he? So he goes on and tells them now, depart from me into this place that's been prepared for the devil and his angels. Why wasn't it prepared for man? Because there's a plan of redemption for man. Man doesn't have to go there. The devil and his angels do. So it was prepared for them. He says, I was hungry and you gave me nothing. I was thirsty and you gave me nothing to drink. I was in prison and you didn't come and visit me. And I was naked and you didn't clothe me. I was sick and you didn't do anything to help me. Then they'll say to the Lord, well, when did we see you hungry or thirsty or a stranger or naked or sick or in prison and did not take care of you? We didn't see you during that time period there just like the other guys didn't. And he says the same thing, but in reverse. He says, truly I say to you, the extent that you did not do it to one of these, you did not do it to me. The fact that you did not help my children means you did not help me. That animosity and anger and hatred that you directed toward them was directed toward me. And these will go away into eternal punishment, but the righteous to eternal life. Again, the concept of our final destiny is eternal. Begins here physically, but will translate into the eternal state. Again, there's no cessation of this place. You can't go into a pit stop and come out of it later. No concept there in the Scriptures. All right, that's theme number three. The future is theme number one. His return and its effect on the Jews is theme number two. And theme number three is his return and its effect on Gentiles. All right, let's talk about this for a second. We've talked about it before, but I just want to remind you of it briefly since we're here. The book of Daniel, Daniel chapter 12, the very last verses of that book, talk about some milestones in terms of dates and time. The angel that's given Daniel this revelation says this to him in verses 11 and 12 of Daniel chapter 12. From the time that the regular sacrifice is abolished and the abomination of desolation is set up, we know when that will be. That's the midpoint of the tribulation period. So from this time right here, he says, there will be 1,290 days. 1,290 days mark some milestone. Some event that is important and matters will occur 1,290 days from the middle of this thing right here. That runs you out 30 days past the end of the tribulation period. 30 days, right? What's going to happen 30 days after the Lord returns here? Then he makes this statement. The same angel makes this statement. How blessed is he who keeps waiting and attains to the 1,335 days. 1,335 days from here runs you out another 45 days past this 30 days. So for a total of 75 days after he returns, something goes on before the millennial kingdom is actually instituted. What goes on during those two times? What happens during these 30 days and these 45 days that is so important and so significant that the millennial kingdom cannot begin until that runs its course and whatever goes on in there is done? I don't know. But here's what I think. We've just seen in our study here of the Olivet Discourse that there will be a separation of the Jews prior to the millennial kingdom. We saw that in these chapters here. And there will be a separation of the Gentiles also prior to the beginning of the millennial kingdom. Is it possible that those two periods of judgment and separations there of Jew and Gentile is what happens in those 30 and 45 days? Is that possible? Heck yeah, it's possible. Is it for sure? No, we don't know. But let's say for a moment that that's what these intervals are about. That 30 days is the separation of the Jews, and that this 45 days gets the sheep and the goats separated. Reasonable? Not saying it for sure is, but is that a reasonable thought that those actions fit into those time intervals? If not, you tell me what does, okay? Show me where this idea is crazy, because it makes sense to me that those two judgments, those two separations, fit into those two intervals. That's why the millennium doesn't begin until it takes place, because only the righteous go in the millennium. They got to be separated first. Now, let's say that is what happens. And again, I'm not certain of it. I just think it is. That means there's how many Gentiles being separated and judged relative to the Jews, would you say?
150%.
1.5 times as many. Does that make sense? Yeah, because it takes 1.5 times as long to separate the Gentiles as it does the Jews. It seems reasonable that whatever the numbers are, there's 1.5 times as many Gentiles that have to be separated as there are Jews, just because of the duration involved. How many Jews are there on this earth? There's about 15 million. About half of them are in Israel, and the other half scattered around the world. There's only about 15 million Jews on there. There are more Arabs in Israel than there are Jews, by the way. So let's say there's 15 million Jews, and let's say they're all in the land. They probably aren't, but a lot of them will go back there. Let's say there's 15 million in the land. We know from Zechariah chapter 12 that 2/3 of them will be killed. Only 1/3 of the Jews will survive the tribulation period. So let's say out of that 15 million, I'm using these nice round numbers here so I can divide in my head. Let's say that 10 million of the 15 are killed and there's 5 million Jews left. That makes sense? If I said anything yet that's crazy? So that when he comes back, let's say there's 5 million Jews left here that have to be sorted out. That would say there's probably about 7.5 million Gentiles, right? 1.5 times. So that would say that there's about, let's say there's 5 million Jews and 7.5 million Gentiles, 12.5 million people to be separated during this time frame here. 12.5 million out of about 8 billion to start with yields a death rate of 99.7%. The other 99.7 people besides these 12 billion or so that we're guessing, and that's a total guess, we don't know this for sure, but it seems reasonable. That says the other 99.7% have been killed. Is that a reasonable conclusion to come to? What did the Lord say about this time period? He said if it went on any longer than the 7 years, nobody would survive it. Zero, zilch, nada. So 99.7 doesn't sound all that crazy when you consider what the Lord said. Amen to that comment.
Yes. Right
back there too, by the way. That is a big number. She followed this logic just perfectly fine. So I don't know. You know, we have to make a few assumptions going through this thought process here. We don't have to assume that these separations are going to take place. That's given to us. We don't have to assume that there's these two interval time frames. What we have to assume is that this fits here and this fits here. That's what I don't know. I don't know anything else that could fit there. And it makes all of the sense in the world based on what we're told about that separation having to occur. So if you grant that that's a reasonable placement of those judgmental events in that 30 and 45 day interval, it can get you to a decent feel for the number of people left on the planet when the Lord comes back, and that can get you to a death rate, which is fantastically high. But it is consistent with what the Lord said about the time frame. Anybody got a question or comment about this little analysis here? Not trying to sell it to anybody. I ain't married to it. But I don't know what's wrong with it. I can't think of why this doesn't make perfectly good sense. Anybody wants to shoot me down, you're welcome.
No, I don't want to do that. I just want to ask a question. Now, the great white throne judgment in Revelation 20, that comes after the millennium.
Yes, that is correct. White throne judgment is the judgment of the lost of all ages that comes after the millennium. So, at any rate, when you take the content of this discourse, the three themes, the future events, the relationship of his second return on Jews, and his relationship to second return on Gentiles, and you try to fit them in with Daniel's prophecy, for which I don't know any other reason or any other thing to fit into those places, that's where you get to this death rate conclusion that's extraordinarily high. Yeah, Elizabeth.
I don't know the exact reference, but when it talks about how we have to answer for like our actions on earth, mm-hmm, and stuff, mm-hmm, obviously there's not a purgatory, but are we in heaven when we're answering for those things?
Yeah, the judgment of believers relates only to works and rewards, mm-hmm, never to eternal destiny. That takes place at what's called the Bema, or the judgment seat of Christ, where he judges our works. Paul describes them in Corinthians as if it's like wood, hay, and stubble, if it's worthless stuff, they're going to be burned up. If it's good stuff, then they will last. But the person himself will not be burned up. It's only the worthless works. So if our works are of no value, no lasting eternal value, we don't get a reward for them. We lose that reward. But we're not lost. The believer is never lost. Our certainty of our being kept secure and our resurrection rests in the decreed will of God, not upon anything anybody else says or does. So that's never in question. But the works are always in question. So we're encouraged to do good works, and they will be judged by the Lord. The white throne judgment is for eternal destiny purposes, and that's why it is so much different. And I've said before, I hope I'm busy that day and can't attend. I don't want to see those people all being cast into the lake of fire. What a horrible scene that will be. Billions upon billions. If there's been 100 billion of us over time, and that's probably a reasonable estimate, probably about 90 billion will be cast into the lake of fire. You want to see that? I don't see that. I'll read about it later or something. I don't want to be near that white throne judgment. That would be such a horrible thing to witness. And the reason for it will be so inexcusable, because whosoever will may come. Nobody has to go there. That's why it is never said of the lake of fire that was prepared for mankind. It is never said that. Only for a devil and his angels, because there is no plan of redemption for them. But for us, there is. So man doesn't have to be at the white throne judgment, but so many will that it's a devastating concept to even marinate on. So let's pass on that one. Any other questions or comments about anything we've talked about here this morning? Three themes to the Olivet Discourse: future events, his return and its effect on Jews, and his return and its effect on Gentiles. That's the three themes of the Olivet Discourse. Any questions or comments about that or this associated idea here? Yeah, Joyce?
The best place is the rapture takes first.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, we'll be... Now, there's some people who don't believe that, but I think they're wrong. I think we're out of there right here. So these things and these horrible events that will take place, Revelation 6 through 19, we will just be some sort of a viewer from the sidelines. We won't be involved with them. We won't be a participant at all. Thanks be to God. There are other people that don't agree with that. But it makes no sense to me whatsoever. Anything other than pre-tribulation or after makes no sense whatsoever. The church is not appointed to wrath, and that is a kind of God's wrath. And faithfulness is rewarded in Scripture, not punished, as you can see in these illustrations we've looked at here this morning. Whatever resources the Lord gives to us, like those guys that got the talents, use them for His glory. It doesn't matter if they're great. It's not a numbers game. Doesn't matter what the numbers are, it's the condition of the heart. It's faithful application of whatever He leaves you with in life, whatever your resources might be, and they don't have to be just financial. That may be something, or may be something else. Use it to His glory. And you too will hear, "Well done, thou good and faithful servant," whatever it may be. So a secondary application of these truths from what the Jews would apply firsthand would be our application of serve the Lord with whatever talents He has given us. And we too will hear that complimentary statement, "Well done, thou good and faithful servant." Questions or comments? Okay. I think we're going to meet again next week normally. But the Sunday between Christmas and New Year's, I think the church has got some special activities going on, and we won't meet that Sunday. Okay? So we're cool. Business as usual next week. But not the one between Christmas and New Year's. We'll take that one off. Everybody okay with that? Okay. All right. We will see you next week, Lord willing.
Yes, I am okay.
Yeah, she's over at the granddaughter's church waving the grandparent flag this morning. Anybody got a drink back there? Scoot this so I don't knock that over. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
You up?
I'm up.
Okay.
That is the biggest help.
Oh, good, good. Glad I could do something in life that actually helped somebody. How you been doing?
Me? Okay.
Yeah. You feeling okay? Good. Good. Yeah. Been doing fine. Passed that one I had, and so right now I'm working on an empty tank, I think.
Oh, good.
Got an x-ray Friday or Thursday, and I couldn't see anything in my kidneys. And so the ones that they said they saw on the CT scan, I couldn't see on the x-ray. So they're either very, very small or they're not there.
Oh, gosh.
That's something I've heard. Yeah, that's what I'd like to be the conclusion. How the kiddos doing?
Oh, gosh.
Everybody doing all right?
She's multiplying by like rabbits.
Yes, ma'am.
Where is the Battle of Armageddon and all of that?
Well, it actually is a campaign, and the armies that will accrue in Israel will actually line up from the north way down to the south for it over a 200-mile stretch. And then when the Lord comes back and slaughters everybody, the death will be up to the horse's bridle for that 200 miles. So it starts way up in the plain of Megiddo and comes all the way down to Edom.
And will that be during the tribulation?
It will be at the second advent when he comes back. They'll be gathering there.
All that, you know.
But when he comes back and wipes them all out. And from north to south, 200.
All of this is so